This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
New voices in your head.
It's Radio Free Radio.
Welcome to Africa Files. I'm Heather Yent. Conflict in Africa is often portrayed in the media as rooted in religion. From the conflict in the Central African Republic that has caused tens of thousands of Muslims to flee the country, to the growth of Islamic extremist groups like Boko Haram in Nigeria and Al-Shabaab in Somalia. Africa Files recently invited two scholars of religion to speak about Christian-Muslim relations in Africa and how this relates to peace and justice across the continent.
Good evening.
Reverend Johnson Mbila is the general advisor for the Program for Christian-Muslim Relations in Africa, also known as PROCMURA, an organization that has promoted Christian engagement with Muslims for peace for more than 50 years. Esha Faki is a lecturer in Islamic studies at Maseno University in Kenya. She researches issues related to the rights of Muslim women. The following is a selection from that talk.
Now, when we talk about the issues of peace and justice, we always need to understand, and I'm sure we do, that peace and justice are very much twin words. They are twin words in the sense that without justice, you cannot have peace. And if you do not have peace, the possibility of being unjust is also there. So when we talk about justice and peace in relation to Christian-Muslim relations in the African continent, all the critical things that you read about and hear about concerning the African continent on matters of conflict, situations of non-peace, where religion is implicated, there are multiple causes. The causes are not just religion, there are multiple causes. One of the causes is the politicization of religion and the religionization of politics. The politicization of religion and the religionization of politics. In the African continent, when Africa became independent, it was always very clear that we have our ethnic identities, or what some people choose to call tribal identities. The forefathers and mothers, forefathers, foremothers of the African continent knew that if we will have to be democratic countries, then we must try as much as possible to ensure that no political party is formed along ethnic lines, or no political party is formed along religious lines. Otherwise, on matters of religion, religion will be politicized, and there will also be the religionization of politics. Those words were not used. I'm using them now because that's what they imply. So you will find out that African constitutions always have a clause that no political party shall be formed along religious lines. Now, apart from South Africa that have violated that principle, and that is, and we say they are learning, a time will come, their constitution will have that clause. But nevertheless, politicians in the African continent, when they go out for their political campaigns, usually talk about the Christian vote or the Muslim vote. Now, when you go for political elections and you are talking about the Christian vote or the Muslim vote, you are in effect trying to politicize religion or religionize politics. Because you come in a manner that you are saying, vote for me as a religious bloc, and I will do A, B, C, D to you, or for you. So politicization of religion is a big issue. Then there is ethnicity finding an ally in religion. Ethnicity finding an ally in religion. It comes like this. When Islam came, certain groups in Africa became Muslim, because that's where Islam entered first. So the people there are Muslims. When Christianity came, certain areas of Africa, the groups, Christianity went there first. And if it was Presbyterian, they are all Presbyterians. If they are Catholics, they are Catholics. If they are this, they are that. So Christianity then goes there, and all that ethnic group are Christians. When this ethnic group are Christians, and the other ethnic group are Muslims, and they have some kind of misunderstanding between the two, and even it is ethnic, the world wants to hear that it is religious. Because then they give it a religious label, the Muslims and the Christians are fighting, and may not say, for example, that the Dagomba, that's northern Ghana, and the Konkomba, Dagomba are mainly Muslim, Konkomba are mainly Christian, they had fought wars, tribal wars. But when we read from outside, it was that it was religious. So that is ethnicity and religion, ethnicity finding an ally in religion. The same thing in the political sphere and the rest of them. The other issue is the historical baggage, which some of you may have heard me mention, the historical baggage. For those who are Christians among us, you know that in Christian history, there was a time when religion and politics were intertwined. They were one and the same. So we then talk very much about Christendom. And Islam, with the time, Islam talked about itself as being a caliphate. The Islamic caliphate and Christendom. Much as Christendom does no longer exist now, and the caliphate also no longer exists, after the formation of nation states, the spiritual significance of the two religions come into play when it comes to matters of politics. And that is Christians always saying all Christians belong to the body of Christ. I think Christians are aware of that. In the body of Christ, there is no north, no south, no east, no west, no black, no white, no yellow. Everybody who is Christian is part and parcel of that body of Christ. In Islam, they have something they refer to as the Ummah, the universal Ummah. Ummah means community. The universal community of Muslims is called the Islamic Ummah. In the Ummah, no north, no south, no east, no west, no black, no white, no yellow. All Muslims belong to the Ummah. So when the system comes like this in the body of Christ there, and the Ummah there, it leads to, as it were, the exportation of conflicts to the African continent, or the importation of conflicts into the African continent. In other words, when the United States, for example, invaded Iraq, or the Allied forces attacked Iraq, for the Muslim world, the body of Christ had attacked the Ummah. You getting that? The body of Christ, that's America, thinking about Christian, had attacked the Ummah. That's Iraq, that's the Muslim. And then it resonates in the African continent. Because the African continent is a religious continent, and the very strong religions in that continent are Islam and Christianity. So you can see how it is clear that global actions can have local impacts. So in our work, we always say that a global world requires a global action. A global world requires a global action. In other words, when we talk about globalization, and we are saying that, oh, the world is global, globalization, then it means before you do something in your area, especially when you are a powerful nation, you must think globally. That means think globally as you attempt to act locally. In other words, know that your local action can have a global implication. When it comes to matters of Christianity and Islam, the two religions that have the greatest following in the world today. So that particular aspect is there and needs to be taken note of. What this then brings to the African continent is what we refer to as negative solidarity. Negative solidarity. What is negative solidarity? Negative solidarity is when you are in solidarity with your own religious group, even when that religious group you know are wrong. When you know that you are wrong, but because you share a religion, you are in solidarity with them, then that type of solidarity is not positive but negative solidarity. And this usually comes because of the universal significance of the two religions, or when there is a problem between a Christian and a Muslim, and sometimes Christians get involved and Muslims get involved, and you ask them, why are you getting involved? And they say, but don't you know that he's a Muslim, or don't you know that he's a Christian? That's negative solidarity, what we try our best to deal with. The other point I'd like us to reflect on is the whole question of radicalization of religion, religious extremism. What in the Christian world we refer to as fundamentalism. And remember that fundamentalism is not a Muslim word. It's a Christian word. In Islam, we talk about extremism. That one can be accepted. Radicalism, that can be accepted. But for some Muslims, not fundamentalism, which they would say the origin is Christian and not Muslim. The whole question of radicalization or religious extremism. How do these come into the fore? They come into the fore and they ride on politics. Thinking, if we come up with a system that will enable us to be politically relevant and dominant, then we will take control of society. And these extremists have history to appeal to. When we talk about religious extremism, let me begin with Islam, from which my sister Aisha comes from. There are, within Islam, groups that we refer to as Salafist movements. You may have heard about Salafists. You know what a Salafist movement? Salafism is a blanket word. What it means is that there are a group who want to go back to the first century of Islam as it was and plant it today that it should be the only way and the only one and only form of Islam. These Salafist movements, they are against Sufi Muslim practices. Sufism in Islam is the mystical form of Islam. They are against the mystical form of Islam because they say those ones are innovations. They are not pure. So they appeal to the pure form of Islam. I have to say this to give you a clear example. So when you hear, for example, you've heard of Al-Shabaab. Have you heard of Al-Shabaab? Al-Shabaab from Somalia. In general terms, they are Salafist movement. You've heard of Boko Haram. They are a Salafist movement. You've heard of Ansar al-Din. That's from Mali. They are a Salafist movement. Or at least you have heard of the Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb. That is a Salafist movement. In other words, there are religious ideologies that come and think that they will be able to overthrow systems that exist and introduce their form of Islam. And this their form of Islam is itself against Muslims as it is against Christians, as it is against any other. Because they are particularistic and exclusive and think that they have the only truth. Then let me turn to Christianity. In Christianity, we have Christian extremist groups. And these Christian extremist groups think that their form of Christianity is the one and only. And anyone who does not subscribe to their form of Christianity, that person is can be qualified to be firewood for hellfire. They will say they have it and the rest do not have it. And so they come in with an intolerant form of Christianity that do not respect the plurality of the African continent. Because the African continent is a plural continent of many religions, a plural continent of many different ethnic groups. In fact, everything that you can talk about plural, you will find it in the African continent.
The war on terror, it has actually been seen and felt by the Muslim community to be a war on them. They are the only ones who are affected by the war on terror. They are the ones who have got their husbands missing, their sons missing, and the other community has seen that these are the perpetrators, the others are the victims. So even if a Muslim, for example, a Muslim leader has come up to condemn what has happened in public, it is not seen as positive. It is like they are trying to show us that they are sorry, but they are actually the perpetrators. So they are not taken seriously. But we have to understand that every religion has got its own people, some of whom have got various extreme ideas, and they should be taken as individuals and not as voices of that particular religion. And the world is becoming, we are becoming more suspicious. We are suspicious of somebody who has done nothing wrong to you. For example, prior to my putting on this wonderful Eid hijab, I had a black thief. So I would observe whenever I enter, for example, an elevator with people, and I just come all of a sudden, he's like, and it is something that it is in the minds of the people, and some people maybe are keeping away, others are looking at me suspiciously. I understand it is the world in which we are being programmed. We become people who are programmed into things that may not have happened to us, but we are living with suspicion, we are living with fear. We do not have open relationships that are supposed to foster peaceful coexistence with one another. There are increasing concerns of militarization in not only in Africa, but also in Asia. We have military bases not belonging to our own countries, but belonging to developed worlds. They are coming to, like in the Francophone, we have French. In the Anglophone, we have the British and the Americans. And the presence of these people, they are not actually, it is not a positive presence in the sense of, in, even if they are providing logistics and all that, but their presence is a disturbing presence in trying to achieve lasting peace in the region, because it keeps people in a constant fear of war. It may happen anytime, because due to our proximity to Somalia, and the Kenya Defense Forces are part of the AMISOM, that is the African mission, it has increased the state of insecurity. So the presence of militarization, or how many military bases we have in different parts of Africa, in Asia, there are so many areas which are being used as naval bases. And not to mention also trade relations between Africa and the West, and now Africa and China. This is upsetting the world order that is on the West. The West had always think that we have a grip on Africa. But China is coming in as a very strong partner. It doesn't give a lot of demands as the West. It doesn't tell us that if you choose this particular leader, they'll be having repercussions. They tell us we are there, we are open. So when we are told that traces have consequences, they say we shall turn to China. All this kind of interplays is making Africa a puppet continent, always at the interplay of the world world forces. Because at one time, who may have known that Siad Barre was a very strong ally of America, and when Ethiopia was considered a communist country, he was advised, go into Ethiopia, you know, we need to destabilize communism. Then at one time, when Somalia now begins the Sharia courts, Ethiopia is told, go into Somalia and destabilize them and make sure that they no longer practice the Sharia code. So there's this interplay where Africa is a small ball that people are throwing left, right, and center. I want to give an example of where we went recently, very recent, that is to Jeju Island. Jeju Island is a small island in the south of South Korea. And next to it is Japan on this side, on this other side is China. The U.S. wants to build a strong naval base on Jeju Island, which was declared after the Second World War an island of peace. So to say that we want to create peace, we want to create justice in the world, but all the time we are creating military bases here, there, here, there. It is creating some sort of anxiety. We are not yet in a state of war. We have invested so much on war, and we are investing very little on peace. Every time there is conflict, who is selling the arms to the people who are fighting? Somebody is doing good business. War is business, good business for that matter. And it doesn't matter who is killed. What matters is that somebody somewhere is doing good business. So not unless the whole society examines the notion of we are creating weapons, and how can we sustain peace when we are actually preparing for war all the time?
But what has to happen is that the world, and for that matter Africa, we have to understand that we all have to accept plurality. That the world is not a monolithic society, the world is a plural society. There is plurality of nationality, there is plurality of color, there's plurality of religion, there's plurality of culture, there is political plurality. All these are what it means for the human existence. So until we accept plurality, including religious plurality, as that which we can live with and respect differences, not as it were to do away with differences, but understand differences and respect them, and know that we have to live with it, we cannot have a peaceful world. So what we advocate for, we advocate for an acceptance that we are a unity in diversity. Our common humanity is crucial. So we are first and foremost human beings who happen to be Muslims, and human beings who happen to be Christians. If we are able to accept that common humanity, then we would have solved the problem and allow variety to be enriching and not a problem. How we go about teaching that? It means that the history of religions, as it were, as you find it among those who are pastors and priests and religious leaders from the Christian faith, they must be able to reorientate their religious teaching to know that they are not the one and only in the world, but that there are other religions. So it calls for real education of accepting the other from the religious leader's perspective. Number two is the entire education system. Even with secular education, that will enable people to accept that there are people of this religion and that religion, or no religion, for that matter, that we have to live with. So education is very, very important. Interestingly, with the organization that I work with a program for Christian-Muslim relations in Africa, we are now advocating very strongly that the theological colleges in the African continent should ensure that they have the teaching of Islam to theological students, so that they come out informed to carry out this aspect of our work. So it's a tough one, but it's an important one. It's an important one in the sense that it means that if I have to relate with Aisha, then I have to know enough about the religion that I do not caricature, unduly use inappropriate language in our relations. So I'm saying that the important thing is actually this aspect of education. And I think there is a basic misconception that suggests that when you study the other religion, the way that their own religious people will study their religion, that it means you will water down your faith. No, you don't. You know, because that we've always taught. You study, there are two ways of studying religion. You can study religion for commitment, but you can study religion for knowledge, for information.
Then our leaders, and I want to talk about religious leaders, they have got peace mantras. We shall live peacefully. They come together, they engage in national prayers, but they cannot sit in a room to engage in the actual issues that affect the Christian-Muslim relations. Each person is afraid to actually spell out the issues. If I go and talk about these issues, somebody knows that when I talk openly about this issue, I'll be chastising my community. Why did you have to say that? No, we have to defend ourselves. That way, it is not actually trying to find solutions, but we keep covering up the solutions. So we meet, we shake hands in public, nice taking pictures, a group of Muslims and Christians have come together to put a common front to condemn something, but the underlying issues, where they can address and which can be disseminated through the various forums, because as religious leaders, they have the mandate. They can go back to their masses. We have people who attend mosques. We have people who attend churches. They can organize and have similar sermons, maybe on a particular issue, and say, this Friday, Muslims will talk about this in the mosque. Christians will talk about this in the churches on Sunday. And that way, I think it will be forging more way forward, instead of just trying to come together for prayers. Anytime when people want to actually call things the way they are told they are disrupting peace, or they're engaged in hate speech. It is not hate speech to actually criticize something that is wrong, but this is how it has been going on. But apart from how do we prioritize the solutions, is that the secular society is a plural society. This is the most important thing. And as a plural society, it is not only in Africa, but it is also something that has happened even here. We need to share our spaces with people who are not in the picture before. They have come and they are here to stay, and they need also to be acknowledged as part of the current process. So sharing of spaces is very important. I want to give an example that we do not need to wait until a problem comes in order for this to be the norm. That is, we accept other people, we understand them, and they may not be like us, but we give them their space. We have our space, they have their space. We do not criticize them as people alien. We do not see them as people who are different from us, but we are all part of the same community. I want to give an example from where I come from, in Kisumu. Around December, the Sikh community was celebrating its 100 years. It has been in the town for 100 years. So they got a roundabout, that is a piece of land which is just about the size of a small roundabout, for 16 million Kenya shillings. That's a lot of money in the country. And they created a monument together with some fountain. And then on top of the monument, they kept a statue of something like saying, thank you, like this. So before it could be unveiled, it was sort of covered. So people were wondering, what is that covered thing? And stories were going on. And by the time it was unveiled, the people said, no, not necessarily Muslim, but most, the majority were Christians. Some of them even, the African Institute churches, even went round in sacks, saying that we shall not have the God worshiping in our town. It is not only your town. These people have been here for 100 years. They also want to claim part, or they want to claim some space. So to actually restrict people and say, this is your space, you cannot have space. Like we have these debates in England, in Switzerland, you cannot have minarets. We cannot hear of mosques or churches in Saudi Arabia. These are all questions of space. As people move and people gain new areas to settle, there is need to share the space and actually share it, not in using words, but by real actions.
So when you talk about the issues of peace and justice, we have a challenge, and the challenge is not just for Africa. The challenge is for Europe. The challenge is for Canada, as it is for Ghana, and as it is for Kenya. For all of us, think about your country. We have a very serious challenge, especially when we are Christians and when we are Muslims. And the greatest challenge that we have is the jargon that Islam puts forward and the jargon that Christianity puts forward. With Christianity, Christians always claim that Jesus is the Prince of Peace. That in the angelic song, when Jesus was born, was peace and goodwill among humankind with whom he is well pleased. In Islam, even though it means submission to the will of God, in Islam is salam, peace. So every day, Muslims greet Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you. How many times they greet in a day? Too much. Quite a lot. In Christianity, you want to go for Holy Communion. Say, shall we share the peace? Yesterday we did it in the evening. Shalom. So peace be upon you. What the world is yearning for, and Africa is yearning for, is that if Christianity and Islam wield the largest following in the world, and the two are religions that have peace at the center. Question, why has the world no peace? Thank you very much.
That was Reverend Johnson Mimbilla and Esha Faki speaking about Christian-Muslim relations in Africa and peace and justice across the continent. Africa Files is a network of volunteers committed to promoting alternative perspectives of African issues. Find out more at africafiles.org. Thank you for listening. I'm Heather Yent.